Welcome to the 125th episode of Reverse Sweat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
It's 21 years to the day that England were knocked out before the group stages in the World Cup that they were hosting. The tournament's official song wasn't even out yet. Welcome to the podcast that rather preferred how things went the next time England hosted.
There is nothing like having to leave your own party early. And the fact that there are sirens in the background isn't a, you know, I'm not about to be dragged off air, I can promise you, if you can hear that in the background. In this episode, we are going to be looking at what's caught our eye in the world of cricket over the last couple of weeks. We're going to be talking about, quotes, the most important figure in Aboriginal Australian sport. And we are going to be completing our two-part review of The Test, A New Era for Australia's Team. Andy, it's nearly June. The cricket season should be about to swing into shape in the UK. It's not, but is there any glimmer of hope here?
Perhaps a glimmer. The sports pages of yesterday's Times had something that would normally be routine but feels pretty radical at present. It was a calendar of this summer's sporting events, and I think a lot of us were giving up on there being any calendar at all. I'm not allowing myself to get too excited as yet. I think there's plenty in there that is as much aspiration as it is certainty. But after all of cancellations, both of, you know, social events, sporting events of last few months, it's impossible not to feel a little bit of joy at the sight of Test series and county championship dates, even if at the moment we're penciling them in rather than, you know, definitely looking forward to them.
And are you you're saying you're not allowing yourself to get too excited, but are you realistically thinking that this summer there is going to be an opportunity to pack your hamper, pack your thermos and head off and sit in the ground?
I don't think so. I think, sadly, my thermos and hamper will be by the side of the sofa rather than at any beautiful county championship games. I guess there's always the possibility. I think some sports are already thinking quite cleverly about social distancing options, but it does feel a long, long way away. But for all that being said, I think we've all missed sport hugely. And I think even if it is in an empty ground with all the oddness and weirdness that that will have, I think the idea of sitting down in front of a screen on the 8th of July to watch England play the West Indies on the Test match feels very special indeed.
Because there have been a few sports that have started in closed stadiums. And actually, I work in the world of music, and there have been a few concerts that have been given, you know, without audiences and have been live streamed and things like that. And it is interesting how quickly you actually get used to that. I mean, in the music world, it's interesting because it being a bit quieter is kind of nice without an audience. But the question of atmosphere, I think, is an interesting one. But I reckon I can absolutely see a situation where we get used to having, you know, grounds that are either empty or have very few people in them and everyone, you know, appropriately spaced out. You can kind of see that becoming a new normal quite quickly.
Well, of course, there are sportsmen who are used to this. I think I saw one Pakistani cricketer making the point that, you know, for Pakistan, who've unfortunately had to play in the UAE a lot in recent years, they've sadly
totally
had to get
stadiums,
used to it.
Yeah.
Exactly. But I think something is clearly lost. I mean, I haven't been watching it too avidly at all, but I know from people who've been watching the Bundesliga, which is the German football league that has rather kind of set the trend in Europe in terms of being the first to return. There has been a feeling that the intensity hasn't been there.
That's just some cats destroying the flat. But I think the most serious question, though, is less about the Test and county schedule and about Pinckney's Green, your beloved Pinckney's Green. What movement, if any, is there on the village cricket scene?
So, sadly, there is no set calendar as yet for the return of the recreational game. I think clubs like Pinckney's Green are showing plenty of innovation. So, I was very impressed to see that when the guidance changed to allow a couple of people to play sport together outside, Pinckney's Green had an online rota for nets. They had hand sanitizer there ready to use. And I think clubs are doing their very best to adapt, but I think I'm not optimistic that I will play cricket before at any point this season.
I wonder whether rubbing hand sanitizer into a ball can be, has advantages in any way. Is reverse swing, you know, hastened by having one side of a cricket ball soaked in hand sanitizer. And is this the new controversy that we, is this sandpaper gate, you know, chapter two waiting to happen?
I think we might well find out in an era where they're not allowed, where they're not, understandably not allowed saliva, the relationship between hand sanitizer and leather, I think we're going to find out pretty soon. Now, you've been looking into the life and times of a writer and editor who we came across recently.
Yeah, so Stephen Fay died a couple of weeks ago. And as is so often the case, I actually kind of learned more about him through his obituaries after his death than I necessarily had when he was alive. We did review recently his book on Arlott and Swanston, which he co-wrote with David Kynaston, and I also knew him in his capacity as the editor of the Wisden Cricket Monthly for several years, but I hadn't realised that he'd had such a remarkable career, actually coming to cricket writing very late. He started off as a business and finance journalist. He was the Washington correspondent of the Sunday Times, and he was the deputy editor of The Independent. He's also on the record as a great lover of opera and theatre, and there was quite an interesting comment from Michael Atherton that I saw where he said that one of the great things about having Stephen Fay in the press box was that he was someone who had such a diverse range of interests. He wasn't, you know, your standard cricket commentator who had been living and breathing nothing but cricket since the age of, you know, 10. And that was such a
beautiful
thing.
And there's something very in the Neville Cardus about this, isn't there? The kind of cricket lover and classical music lover. And I think it's wonderful that writers like this are still finding a role in cricket journalism, because obviously there's been a lot said about the movement towards ex-pros, many of whom, you know, like Atherton, are wonderful writers. But there's certainly something that those all-rounders bring to the sport and bring to the writing.
Absolutely. And the point that Atherton was making was that it was actually just a beautiful thing to have someone who you could talk to about things that weren't cricket in the press box, you know, someone who just had such a broad range of interests. The other thing that leapt out at me reading about Stephen Fay was the fact that he had really kind of made a point of championing young journalists throughout his career, and that he actually gave some of the first opportunities to two beautiful cricket writers, Emma John and Tanya Aldridge at The Guardian, really before, and this is a point that Emma John made, before the idea of women writing about cricket was, you know, frankly, and it kind of feels awful to say it, but it kind of wasn't seen as being the done thing. And Stephen Fay was someone who went, "You're great writers, I'm going to give you a chance and I'm going to give you an opportunity as well."
From the archives, in this episode, Toby is going to tell us the story of the most important figure in Aboriginal sport.
So it's Reconciliation Week here in Australia, which has led me to dive into the archives a little bit and look at some Indigenous sport. As many people will know, Australia has a bit of a tortuous relationship with its Indigenous past, and Reconciliation Week is a week that happens every year, which is all about kind of moving forward the dialogue between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians, and also about celebrating the value and the kind of incredible value of Aboriginal people and Aboriginal culture. And so in the spirit of that, I wanted to talk about the person who has been cited, as you say, as the most important figure in Aboriginal sport, which is a trailblazing Indigenous woman by the name of Faith Thomas. Faith Thomas was born in a small remote community in South Australia. When she was just 3 months old, she was taken away from her parents as part of the official policy to rehome Indigenous children with white families. So the idea was that this would, you know, civilize, in large inverted commas, those children by putting them into a white context. The reality was that it was obviously, you know, a huge breach of human rights that's come to be known under the name of the stolen generation. And so Faith Thomas was a child of the stolen generation, but her childhood proved very formative for her in terms of shaping what was quite a remarkable life. And interestingly, her first contact with cricket came when, and I don't think, you know, in any way maliciously, but she was playing as a young girl, and there was a game of cricket happening nearby, and a ball flew over, as it did, and hit her in the head. And, you know, that's we all know, we've all been hit in the head by cricket balls. That can be quite a painful thing. Interestingly, though, her take on that was to think, okay, well, if this is a game where you can get hit on the head by the ball, then I need to learn to do the thing that stops me from doing that, which is actually being able to bat properly. And that's the reason she decided she needed to play cricket.
It sounds like one of those beautiful twists of fate you get early on in a novel, isn't it? This sort of, you know, this heaven-sent cricket ball to lure our protagonist into a lifelong passion for the game.
Exactly. What's interesting, though, is that she obviously liked kind of being on the other side of things, because she wasn't ended up not being much good as a batsman, but was a phenomenal bowler. She was known as being the fastest female bowler of her time, mostly playing in the 50s. She actually attributes this to another childhood activity, which is throwing stones at galahs, which are like kind of colorful parakeets, and that she, you know, said the what that taught her was two things, one of which was strength, and the other of which was kind of real accuracy, because you had to, obviously, if a bird is flying through the air, you have to kind of preempt where it's going to be, because it's a moving target. As a bowler, she went on to, you know, achieve some remarkable things. She once took 6 for none in a club game in Adelaide. I mean, that's pretty impressive figures. There's another moment in her career that is captured by a brilliant photo. It's the England captain, Mary Duggan. This is when the England women's test team was touring Australia in, I think, 1958. And the England captain, Mary Duggan, was clean bowled. And one of her stumps cartwheeled so far that it ended up behind the wicketkeeper, which I think just gives you a bit of an indication of the quite the pace that she bowled at.
And what I guess is heartening about this is that her talent allowed her to get through to national level and national recognition. I mean, do you have a sense of sort of how much of a struggle that was? Or was there a sense that by this point, Australia had started to make progress in its relationships with the indigenous communities?
No.
And there was a kind of natural route for her? Or
I think she did this against all of the odds. So she went on to become the first indigenous person to win a test cap for Australia. In 1958, she played against England at the Gabba. But she had to do all of this despite every conceivable barrier being put up against her, and simply by the fact that she was, one, tenacious. I think there was sort of an accepted status quo that if you're indigenous that you were essentially segregated, and she just didn't accept that. And she also was hugely talented, so I think she kind of was able to really make the case for herself. She would actually have gone on to have had a much, much more significant career, but she didn't, because she actually refused to go on the long boat journeys. You know, she was someone who grew up thousands of miles from the coast, and the idea of spending 4 weeks on a boat to go to England was something that kind of slightly horrified her. And so she refused to go to, I think, even to New Zealand, let alone to England for tours. And that really kind of cut her career short. The other thing that I think really illustrates the fact that she was a real trailblazer who didn't let what the accepted conventions were for a woman and an indigenous woman hold her back was that she was one of the first indigenous college graduates in Australia, and she was also one of the first indigenous nurses as well.
Her story is extraordinary. I mean, I guess the slight disappointment and frustration is that the story is not better known and more widely known, but also the fact, I mean, I think you're quite right to say trailblazer in terms of no one had done this before, but sadly it's a trail that hasn't been much followed, has it? I mean, there certainly have been successful indigenous cricketers on the men's side, and I think people like Dan Christian and Andrew Simons, but I mean, to my knowledge, having a quick look ahead of this podcast, on the women's side, she hasn't been much followed. So maybe there is a slight disappointment there that hasn't led to a kind of an ongoing relationship between indigenous communities and the women's game.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, actually. And I honestly just don't know the number of indigenous cricketers there are, for instance, who have gone on to play test cricket for Australia. I just don't know. Certainly there are certain sports that you look at, something like AFL, Aussie Rules, and that has a really, really significant take up from indigenous people. In fact, you know, most of the superstars, a lot of the superstars of the game are indigenous in AFL. What's interesting is that when Thomas reflects on what it is that's kind of kept her out of the game, it's kind of, I think for her, it's a little bit less the Indigenous side of things, and it's more about being a woman in a game where she says that when she was playing the game, and it was the era of the Don Bradmans and the Lindsay Hassetts and those kinds of people, she actually said that there was a real sense that she got that those men were actually just terrified of the idea of women who could potentially actually be, you know, as good at cricket as they were, which is something that she kind of identifies as absolutely still existing within, you know, within Australian sport to the present day as well. The review, and today we are completing our review of The Test, A New Era for Australia's Team. It's a documentary that's on Amazon Prime. In the 124th episode of Reverse Swept Radio, we reviewed episodes 1 to 4, and for today we have been watching episodes 5 to 8. It's a documentary that follows, I suppose, the rebuilding of the Australian team after Sandpaper Gate through to the end of the last Ashes series. Andy, from this second half, what do you think we learn, or what did you learn about how an international cricket team actually works?
I learned much less than I'd hoped, you know, for 8 hours of footage of a team in action. I'm not entirely sure why. Was it the Australian team keen not to give away too many trade secrets? Perhaps it was Amazon being anxious about scaring off casual viewers. But I don't think we got nearly enough about the nuts and bolts of how a team works and thinks and plans. We got a couple of moments. So I really enjoyed the run-up to playing England at the World Cup, where you saw the discussion and strategy around their decision to play with two left-armers. I would have loved more of that. We also saw Justin Langer, who, for better or worse, and this really depends on your view of Justin Langer, is kind of the closest this has to a sort of star character or lead. He makes this decision during an ODI series in India to give the players more control over their training, and he concludes that they work a lot harder, which I thought was quite interesting, and I think possibly quite a difficult move for someone who's clearly quite a sort of control freak. There's the fascinating moment in the Ashes series where Tim Payne wins the toss and bowls at the Oval in the fifth test, and all the coaches seem astonished. And I couldn't get my head around this. How had they not talked about it
already? Yeah, exactly. Well, there are a couple of moments like that.
Payne just went rogue.
Yeah, there are a couple of moments like that with Payne. There's also some fielding decisions that he makes in, for instance, the Headingley test, where the coaches are sitting there kind of scratching their heads. But I think it is an interesting question about, you know, this is this is the most access that any of us will ever get to the dressing room of an international cricket team. And I think you're absolutely right that you do get the sense that what they're trying to do is create something for the general audience, and therefore anything that gets too much into the detail of the cricket is kind of shied away from slightly. I mean, it's a little bit like, you know, would you actually expect to learn how to bobsleigh by watching Cool Runnings? You know, that's kind of a bit of an equivalent that kind of springs to mind for me. I think you're right. There are these little moments that kind of strike you as interesting. But I think also without having because there's no narrator to the series or no kind of, I don't know, there's no kind of journalistic approach. Nothing gets sort of followed up on in a way. We just see this kind of series of vignettes. And as you go through the eight episodes, it starts feeling a bit samey because we see the same stuff coming back.
Well, I agree with you that the closest we have to a narrative is this line around new era for Australia's team. You know, as you said in the introduction, building on sandpaper, building, getting beyond Sandpaper Gate, building a new era. I mean, as you say, lots of vignettes. Are you convinced by the end of this? Do you feel this truly was a new era, a new culture that the documentary, and clearly Justin Langer in particular, is really keen to convince us of?
There's certainly a really interesting narrative that comes around rebuilding. And it's basically the rebuilding that needs to be done when you take Smith and Warner out of the side. I mean, that's fundamentally the problem that is being dealt with here. Actually, the problem of the culture in Australian cricket seems to me to actually be kind of brushed under the carpet a little bit, not least because, you know, there are these scenes where they go and visit Gallipoli and blah, 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 but they did that in 2005 back in the day. Like, people always go and visit battlegrounds and talk about what comradeship means and we're like the soldiers of, you know, we're the equivalent to that. I was really interested when I think in episode 5 or 6, when Smith and Warner come back into the side for the World Cup, World Cup that England won last summer. And really interesting to see the kind of total lack of contrition around any of the, or at least what we see, from what we see, there's a total lack of contrition. It's kind of referred to, they occasionally refer to their mistake, which just seems like a total glossing over of something that was, you know, what was a big deal, whether you think that they should, you know, be criminals forever or not. Like, it was a big deal that people reacted to in a certain way, and you just don't get the sense from them or the rest of the players that they really get that.
Well, Glenn Maxwell at one point says it felt like us against the world, and it really jarred with me a bit, because I was like, well, it wasn't us again. You know, there were a sizable number of England fans and other fans who chose to boo Smith and Warner because of what they had done. The idea that it was some kind of really anti-Australian thing, I found that a little bit jarring, but it was interesting to see how the team kind of turned it to their advantage and used it as motivation. For me, Usman Khawaja, and I mentioned this when we reviewed the first four episodes, I think comes out of this as a really interesting kind of thinking cricketer. And for me, he is the one who cuts through the mateship and all the talk about this. And he says, I've seen teams that don't get along at all win games. Camaraderie's great. At the end of the day, you've got to play some good cricket. And this is exactly coming back to your point, that really, for all the talk about culture, this is about a team that loses two world-class batsmen, has to deal without them, and then welcomes them back. And my feeling about this new era is that ultimately, for all the talk about culture, the team is saved by the return of Smith and Warner, and the fact that, to their, you know, to the credit, I'm sure, of a lot of planning, they managed to get those wonderful bowlers all fit and all firing at the same time. But I never quite buy the narrative that what we're seeing is the product of this new culture.
So 8 hours of documentary we sat through for you, dear listeners. We're nothing if not self-sacrificial. What were the moments that stick in your mind?
I remember so vividly that Archer bowling spell at Lord's. Mm. And, you know, there's one thing when, of course, he hit Smith, which is extraordinary. But it's the moment when he hits Marcus Labuschagne, who, let's remember at this point, we don't know who Marcus Labuschagne is. You know,
in fact, he's called Marnus. We know so little about him, we don't even know Marnus, his first name.
Marnus, we don't even know. So by the end of the summer, he's obviously become something of a, you know, star. But the moment that really stuck with me, Ben Stokes in the slip has his hands on his head. He looks completely distraught. And I think it was a reminder that for all the competitive instinct, for all the desire to win, there is a real camaraderie and a sense of no cricketer wants to see that, however much they want to win. I think we were both united in admiring one truly beautiful moment at Headingley.
It was a beautiful at the end of the Headingley test, when of course Ben Stokes and Jack Leach pulled off the great escape, and there's some footage of the coaches sitting, you know, in the coaches' room watching this unfold, and the various moments when Australia blow the review, then can't have review the one that is Plum from Lyon, and then the run out when, and I can't remember whether it's actually Stokes or Leach, but miles out of their ground, throw comes in, Lyon completely fumbles it. Langer in the coach's box turns around and kicks over this bin down these stairs. And he is obviously absolutely just totally, totally furious. Kicks over this bin, and then for probably a good 45 seconds or so, we just watch him, the camera stays on him, and we just watch him picking up all of the things that have come out of the bin and putting them back in the bin. And somehow it is just kind of comedy gold. It's just one of those beautiful moments, probably unintentionally, one of those beautiful, totally surreal moments where you see Justin Langer at the moment that they're about to lose this pivotal test match, and he's there picking up bottles from the floor and putting them back into a recycling bin.
I think it somehow captures something very much of the essence of Justin Langer, his kind of self-help wisdom approach to everything. But no, it's wonderful, and it's as dramatic as anything else in that extraordinary chase.
So, what would you say is the Reverse Retro Radio verdict on this documentary series? Are we recommending it?
So I think this whole streaming era, Netflix, Amazon Prime, etc., has been wonderful for documentary makers. There's this rather interesting thing that documentaries don't tend to do brilliantly at the cinema, but oddly, we tend to stream them in vast quantities. They've been a real triumph. And as a result, these streaming services are happy to invest. And I think that's wonderful that series like this are being made. I do wonder, though, if it hasn't encouraged a certain flabbiness. So Netflix, Amazon, etc., they want content. They want long series. I question whether this needed to be 8 episodes. I have to say, the episode lengths vary a bit between, I think, 50 minutes and an hour. And I felt myself sighing a bit when I saw particularly some of the later episodes. I was like, oh, goody, you know, a whole hour, which isn't a great sign. All that being said, I think I would struggle to think of a cricket fan who would not enjoy this.
Yep.
There is plenty in there. For all its flaws, there is plenty in there.
And there is some remarkable cricket matches that it covers, and it's worth watching it for the highlights of those as much as anything. I think the other thing that it really lacked, and this came back to something that we talked about in our review of the first 4 episodes, was the fact that it's something that is endorsed and was probably, you know, encouraged by the Australian setup as being the mechanism through which they could prove that actually we're nice men. And, you know, that review that was in The Spectator where it said you'll never hate an Australian cricketer again. Well, like, that is job done for the PR person in Cricket Australia who set this whole thing up. And therefore,
I now like Nathan Lyon. I can't believe it, but I like Nathan Lyon. I mean, how did that happen?
And what I think comes... Yeah, and there are a few people I dislike even more, David Warner being one of them. But yeah, I agree with you that there are some cricketers who you come out of it thinking, actually, they seem like good, decent human beings. But what you just wanted was a bit of journalistic rigor at times. You know, you wanted someone to be able to ask the hard questions and actually to interrogate, rather than it to be a parade of talking heads describing this wonderful renaissance in Australian cricket.